Welcome to today's program titled FCC Privacy Rules, Part 1, Opt-ins and Opt-outs, the New Regime. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen. Type your question and click on the Send Message button. At the end of today's event, a link to an online evaluation will be displayed on your screen. Please take a few minutes to complete it. We do appreciate your feedback. I would now like to introduce our hosts for today's call. Kristen McNeely, you may begin.
Hi, thank you. And thank you for everyone for participating today, and welcome to the first in a two-part series. We, as you may have noticed, and we forgot to tell our moderator, that we've actually switched things up a little bit, and I think the reasons for our change will become apparent by the end of the first slide, actually. So just as a reminder of why we're all gathered here today, the FCC, as we all know, adopted new privacy rules at the end of October. The new privacy rules established data security obligations as well as new notice and consent obligations for carriers as well as interconnected VoIP providers. And by carriers, we mean both traditional telecommunications carriers and now the ISPs who are subject to Title II as of today under the under the Commission's reclassification. The new rules were different in several key aspects from the Federal Trade Commission's regime. In some instances, especially data security, which is what we're going to focus on today, they actually are very similar, but there are some other points where they diverge considerably. Most of those will be the subject of Part 2, and they relate to the notice and consent and the definition of sensitive information that we'll talk about a week from today. The rules themselves were adopted along a 3-2 party line vote. The Republicans, it's important to note, said that they would have supported these rules if they had truly mirrored the FTC framework. And I think that's really important to think about as we go into a little bit of what the fate of these new rules could be in the next administration. So unless everybody's been asleep for, you know, the past several weeks, we're going to switch from a Democrat-led FCC to a Republican-led FCC under the new administration come January 20th. And what that means for these rules, since both of the Republicans, whose terms do not expire at the end of this year, and will continue to be there after the inauguration. Both of the Republicans voted against these privacy rules. There was also Republican support for not passing these rules or for limiting the rules to be consistent with the Federal Trade Commission's framework before the vote was taken. And, you know, all of this, again, as I mentioned before, ties into the whole reason for the new rules, was because of the reclassification from for ISPs from an information service to a telecommunications service. As a result, they no longer fell under the FTC's framework, and so it created a gap that the Federal Communications Commission thought that it needed to fill, being the sole regulatory agency for common carriers. So what does that mean for these rules and what can happen? There are a lot of things that can happen. First of all, the rules as of today have not been published in the Federal Register. We do think that the rules will be published, will ultimately be published in the Federal Register, and because of that, as we talk about deadlines in a couple of slides, some of the rules will go into effect before January 20th. So the they could go into effect before January 20th. So if that happens, then several of the rules are subject to OMB approval, which is under the jurisdiction of the executive, you know, directly controlled by the executive office. So one possibility is that part of the rule, you know, either the rules never get published in the Federal Register, or the rules do get published in the Federal Register and some go into effect, but OMB never approves the remaining rules, so now you're left with a partially effective order. Or you could also see under the Congressional Review Act, this will clearly fall within the 60 legislative day time frame, and Congress could actually roll back the entire order. Additionally, depending on what happens with Title II, and I have no crystal ball, but you know that's not going to happen. That's not going to be a January 20th event. That will take more time. But depending on what happens with Title II, that also will have an effect on these rules and how they are ultimately implemented or effective. So you may be sitting there going, well, why the heck am I here and what does this mean for me? And you know, going back to the 3-2 party line vote, privacy is a bipartisan issue, and there would have been support for rules that mirrored the FTC. Of all of the rules that are, you know, of all of the parts of the new rules, the data security rules most resemble the FTC's rules. And therefore, it is likely that you know, if these are published, they will be in place for some time. Additionally, these are very similar, the requirements in the new FTC rules. You're probably already subject to very similar requirements, whether it's under state law or whether it is because the Federal Trade Commission will ultimately have jurisdiction over data security. So with all of that said, you know, let's jump into the program. And the first thing we will talk about is deadlines. I want to talk a little bit about the scope of the new rules because there was very clearly some information that was carved out of the you know there that is not subject to the new rules. Then we're going to talk a little bit about your data security program and what the requirements are and providing some implementation recommendation and tips. And finally, data breach notification and preparedness recommendations. So on looking at the deadline specifically, once this is published, the take-it-or-leave-it offers, you know, conditioning a customer's receipt of service on a waiver of their privacy is going to be prohibited within 30 days. Similarly, the business customer exemption goes into effect after 30 days. And just as a reminder, the rules themselves exempt voice services, but they do not really discuss bias services as being exempted from the rules when it is subject to an enterprise-wide agreement. That doesn't mean that they're not. If we recall the definition of broadband internet access service is a mass market retail service, so by definition, your enterprise agreements are not mass market retail services and therefore are not subject to these privacy rules. This is the, you know, the in red, this is why we're here today talking about the data security requirements because these are not subject to OMB approval and will go into effect 90 days after publication in the Federal Register, which again, you know, we do expect that to happen fairly soon. And finally, OMB approval is going to be required for all of the notice and consent provisions and the breach notification provisions. We're going to talk about breach notification today just because it falls in line with data security, and you're still going to have breach notification requirements under the existing CP&I rules until and unless they're phased out, as well as your state data breach notification rules and other security notification requirements. So looking at what the scope of the new rules are, you know, again, the rules apply to telecommunications carriers, which now include ISPs as well as interconnected VoIP providers. And in addition to CP&I, which was covered under the prior FCC rules, we now have this broader set of information that is subject to protection. It's called customer proprietary information, and it includes not only CP&I, but also personal information, personally identifiable information, and the contents of communications. each of these are defined very broadly, and the commission throughout applies a risk-based or sensitivity-based framework. And this is one of the points where it very much diverges from the FCC or from the Federal Trade Commission's rules. It incorporates health, financial, children, social security numbers, and precise geolocation information, which is similar to the FTC. And in the FTC's comments, they also talked about the content of communications, and the FCC adopted that. But the FCC also included web browsing history and app usage history, which is much broader than what the Federal Trade Controls, or the Federal Trade Commission guidance has included. And this is the subject of a lot of disputes and partially the cause of the dissents from the Republicans. Finally, what is out of scope? The rules do not apply, and this is really important. If you have other services, such as video services, that are not subject to Title II, that information obtained from those services will not fall under these rules. Similarly, information that you gather from your websites or applications, unless it's something that's being used to actually provide bias, or it's an online application where you're collecting service in order to provide bias, that information is also supposed to be out of scope. And of course, information that you obtain from third parties is out of scope. De-identified information is also out of scope. And there, the FCC did adopt the FTC's framework, which is a three-part test, and states that information must not be reasonably linkable to an individual or device. There has to be a public commitment, once that information is de-identified, that it will be continue to be used and maintained in a de-identified manner and not re-identified. And then also, when you're disclosing de-identified information to a third party, there has to be a contract between you and the third party that prohibits the third party from attempts to re-identify the data. So with that background and setup, Casey, do you want to talk a little bit about the data security?
Yes, great. Thanks, Kristen. So as Kristen noted, we're here to focus on really two components of the privacy order, the data security rule, which I'll talk about now, and then the breach notice rule, which my colleague Alex Reynolds will talk about in a moment. This slide, reflects what the FCC has said with respect to the data security rule, and as you can see, there's not a lot here. The basic principle we're talking about is every covered provider has a duty to take reasonable measures to secure a customer PI. But what does that mean in practice? That's the challenge that we're all facing now, and hopefully our discussion today will help flesh that out a little bit. But it's an ongoing challenge, and as you will see from this discussion, there's other best practices or other agency guidance that we think may be useful guidance for us going forward. But as the rule makes clear, providers have a duty to protect customer PI from unauthorized use, disclosure, or access. Initially, when the FCC issued its notice of proposed rulemaking in this proceeding, it was considering a much broader framework. They talked about adopting an overarching data security expectation. But thankfully, when implementing the order itself, they took steps back from that and adopted instead this reasonableness standard. A couple of points to consider as we work through this. First, the FCC is not specifically mandated any activities here. So they've made it clear there's no clear safe harbor here or required steps that need to be taken. Instead, the FCC is offering guiding principles and what it calls exemplary activities. And in describing this new rule, it's used adjectives like robust, flexible, evolving, and future-focused. So that gives us some sense of how the FCC views this new duty. The FCC also believes that this rule is consistent with current FTC best practices, which require companies or suggest that companies make reasonable choices with respect to data security. And the FCC has also said it's consistent with FTC enforcement actions, which in the past have required companies to take reasonable and appropriate steps to protect the data they collect. There are also analogs in state law to this principle as well. So there is, again, some law out there that helps inform what this new rule means. The key question, we think, in the end is whether a provider is taking reasonable steps to secure the customer PI. Reasonableness, the FCC has told us, is based upon context. So the FCC will be looking at a provider's security practices contextually. And in particular, they'll look at these four factors in considering whether or not that provider's data security program is reasonable. The nature and scope of the activities at issue, the sensitivity of the data that the provider collects, the size of the data, and the technical feasibility will all be factors that will help contextualize the provider's program. With respect to technical feasibility, that is a reminder that the FCC views data security practices and the technology surrounding much of these data security practices as an evolving standard. And certainly we know that technology evolves very quickly. The FCC expects providers to continually update and renew their technology as new technology comes online. Also important to remember that the new reasonableness standard covers both sensitive and non-sensitive data. So what that means is that providers need to calibrate their practices to the sensitivity of the data. More sensitive data obviously requires enhanced or greater security practices. One final consideration here. The FCC has said that cost considerations are permitted. So providers can consider costs when evaluating which security measures they should be adopting. As I noted earlier, the FCC was clear that it didn't want to dictate a minimum set of requirements. Instead, it offered these exemplary practices that it views as useful and helpful in providing guidance as to what constitutes reasonable data security practices. It stayed away from dictating a minimum set of requirements because it believed that doing so would promote a quote-unquote compliance mindset, and that approach conflicted with the evolutionary nature of the technology at issue and the evolving data security threats out there. So we're not going to walk through each one of these. Some of these are self-explanatory, but I did want to touch on several of them. The second bullet talks about implementing up-to-date best practices. And again, that's just a reminder that the FCC views this new standard as an evolving and future-focused standard that requires providers to continually be looking at available technology and the latest security threats. With respect to the third bullet, designation of a senior management official responsible for implementing and overseeing the data security program, that's pretty cut and dry. It's pretty clear and straightforward. Larger organizations likely have individuals who already have a duty like this, a CIO or somebody similar. Smaller organizations may not have a dedicated official responsible for information oversight. Nonetheless, somebody ought to be taking the lead with respect to implementing and overseeing a data security program. The fifth bullet talks about establishing robust customer authentication practices. And we wanted to take a minute here to talk about the customer authentication practices that apply to voice services. Those that have been offering interconnected voice services know that in 2007, the FCC set out a pretty complicated authentication requirement regime, which took some time and effort to fully implement. But the FCC has now said, under this new data security standard, The old voice customer authentication rules will be harmonized with the new data security standard. Practically, that means the old voice customer authentication rules will soon go away once or if this rule is fully implemented. And it's important to note that the FCC has not identified specific authentication requirements under this new rule. Instead, they've said those requirements must be reasonable and evolving and future-focused. One more reminder here, the adoption of all or some of these practices does not constitute a safe harbor. So again, we can't simply check these boxes and assume that the FCC will believe or find that we're fully compliant.
And Casey, maybe this is a good point. There's been a question that was asked about, will the CPNI record keeping and annual certification be required in March 2017? The order eliminates, but unsure of the effective date of that 30 days question mark. And we've done some analysis of this, and I think it's important to note, just as Casey said, when the new rules come into effect for authentication and reasonable data security, the old authentication rules are going to go away. And throughout the order, you know, they talk about this replacement. Unfortunately, the ordering clauses themselves are very confusing, and if you took them literally, there would be, for instance, two definitional sections in existence at the same time. So we do expect, depending on, again, what happens with this order, that there will be some cleanup of that. But if the new rules get published in the Federal Register, let's say tomorrow, and within 90 days, it's, you know, if that turns out to be before, I think that it might be just before March 1st, then you wouldn't be required to file your certification for in March of 2017. If the new rules have not gone into effect, the old rules then still exist, and certification would be required. And I think it's also important to note that, you know, that certification is important, and going back to the bipartisan effort, even, or the bipartisan interest in privacy and security, even under a Republican administration, there was enforcement of the CPNI certification rules. And so you do need to take this seriously regardless of who is in control of the agency.
Great. Thanks, Kristen. The question, now that we have a general understanding of what this reasonable standard, what the FCC has in mind with this reasonableness standard, is sort of where does the rubber hit the road? How do we interpret and implement the standard to a data security program? The good news is that the FCC walked away from adopting a strict liability regime. The bad news is that the guidance they offered remains sometimes challenging to apply in the real world. So the FCC has said they would evaluate this on a case-by-case basis. Obviously, with all of the changes that Kristen has talked about in the administration and the new administration coming in, it's unclear how the new administration will implement and enforce these rules. What we can say, though, is, as Kristen mentioned, even under prior Republican regimes, there have been data security enforcement actions. And looking back at relatively recent FCC and FTC data security enforcement actions, we can take away a couple of concrete principles here. One, the implementation of a written data security program has always seemed to be a necessary requirement. Two, conducting penetration testing of systems and databases is seen as an important security protocol. Another important protocol that prior FCC and FTC enforcement actions have pointed to is conducting data minimization practices, especially the most sensitive information collected. And finally, audits, whether on an annual or semi-annual basis, again, is something that prior administrations have pointed to as reasonable data security practices. So where does that leave us? What recommendations can we offer you today? Well, as we've noted, a comprehensive written information security program is critical, and we think that that program should assess current security practices, identify threats, identify data that may be at risk, and finally, most importantly, implement the controls necessary to minimize those security risks. Concrete steps to develop strong accountability and oversight are critical. So, doing things like developing a written data security program, training employees and contractors and agents who may have access to the PI on how to handle that customer PI, obtaining data security commitments from third parties that may have access to the data, robust customer authentication, that's another component we've already talked about, and embracing data minimization principles. The FTC disposal rule offers guidance on the destruction and disposal of CPI. And finally, periodic reassessments of authentication and security protocols. My colleague Adam Shoemaker is going to discuss some of the specific tools that we've been working on to help providers come into compliance and implement a lot of these concrete steps. The FCC has also pointed to guidance from other federal agencies as either useful or helpful in determining what constitutes a reasonable security practice. So we've listed them all here, the NIST Cybersecurity Framework, the FTC's Start with Security Best Practices, the CISRIC Advisory Committee. All of these are cited as useful guidance for providers to implement certain elements of these best practices. Well, I'll make just a couple points here. With respect to the CISRIC guidance, the FCC has said that that offers valuable cyber risk assessment protocols. The NIST cybersecurity framework is quite broad. The FCC has made clear that it's not mandated but could be implemented at least in part as appropriate. And the FTC guidance offers, again, several concrete steps that providers can take, talking about things like implementing security passwords and authentication, storing sensitive PI securely and protecting it during transmission, securing remote access to the network, and finally putting procedures in place to keep security current and to address vulnerabilities that may arise in the future. Again, remember the FCC has said this is an evolving standard that should be future focused. And with that, I'm going to hand this off to my colleague Adam Shoemaker to talk about some of the steps necessary to begin implementation of a data security program.
Thanks, Casey. As the header on this slide indicates, one of the questions you have to ask yourself beginning this process is what CPI do you have and where do you keep it? And we might add to that what are the threats that face it? And the standard way to evaluate that question, those questions, is to begin with a series of assessments of your organization and identify the records that need to be protected. We have listed here a risk assessment and a gap assessment. A risk assessment is really meant to be a sort of high-level overview, maybe made of a panel of supervisors of different parts of the organization to identify threats facing each segment of the business. And once that sort of threat list has been developed, you can then implement a gap assessment to go throughout the organization, top to bottom, to figure out where the gaps are in your current security program that those threats might harm. And that is often done by polling or surveying in the field personnel and people who really know the day-to-day operations of the organization best. It would be sort of the front line of defense against security threats. Hand-in-hand with that, obviously, is the process of identifying CPI, figuring out where it's located within your organization, how it's maintained, and how it's protected. And that, you really need to devise that sort of survey based on information from all personnel in the organization. And in doing so, identify all materials, no matter the format, that contain CPI. Once those assessments and that survey has been completed, then you need to begin to think about the controls that you either have already or need to implement to keep that data secure. And those, there's a long list, as you can see, of various types of controls that will accomplish that goal. Control access, both physical and electronic, tracking program to keep tabs on where the CPI is located and how it's transmitted and stored, a program to continually update all software within the organization to incorporate latest patches, particularly software that touches any CPI, and just implementing other good IT practices, including having firewalls, antivirus software, and using encryption to the extent possible. And all those together, as Casey pointed, that while there's no safe harbor, these are good practices that we believe the SEC will look upon with favor when it comes to the point where they're reviewing your data security program. And as Casey also mentioned, we here at DWT have been working on a suite of templates and tools to sort of start the ball rolling for our clients. And there are a number of different types of policies and written practices that you can have in place depending on the size and sophistication of your organization. There's, as the SEC has fortunately acknowledged, there's no one-size-fits-all set of policies and procedures that will work for all companies. But some policies that are common elements of secure business practices include, obviously, the written data security program, which we really think is a necessity, an acceptable use policy for employees, along with an access agreement, employee handbook and privacy policy, policy that details when and how you use encryption, incident response plan, which will touch on the breach notification rules that my colleague Alex will discuss, and a records and information management policy. Not all of these have to be separate standalone documents. They can be folded into one another as necessary, but they're really sort of touch points to begin thinking about what are the sort of different points that your data security program should touch on and which you should have sort of independent thinking. Once the data security program is in place, how do you keep it current and how do you make sure it's implemented properly? Obviously, one of the first steps is training all the relevant personnel and contractors and third-party vendors who are going to need to be a part of the implementation of this program. That begins with looking at the training you have now and figuring out the best way to update it to incorporate the changes that you'll be implementing. And as Casey noted, because this standard, this SEC requirement, is meant to be continually updated, so should your training. And so a review of the training and updates on a regular basis are going to be required as well. And finally, giving this program some teeth, enforcement. You really need to have some mechanisms to react to violations of the privacy and security protections to make sure that personnel take these measures seriously and understand the consequences for lapses and violations. Because, as Alex will note, the intention behind someone who may breach the secure data is irrelevant under the FCC's view. It's critical, absolutely critical, that everyone within your organization understand what the practices are that they should and should not be following to keep data secure, and that they don't inadvertently get access that they're that's not permissible under their role within the organization. So that's all part of enforcement. And with that, I'm going to hand it over to what I've mentioned a couple times now, which is my colleague Alex Reynolds' description of the data breach notifications.
Thanks very much, Adam. So,
Alex, do you mind if I just take 1 minute?
Absolutely. We've had a question.
we've had a question, so we'll just take them in order. There was a question about discussing the small system exemptions and the effect on the 90-day implementation window, and the FCC crafted its order in a way where they felt like the bulk of the requirements would be equally applicable to all parties. And as Casey noted earlier, because they are going to take size and technical feasibility and other factors into account, they felt that small providers could come into compliance with these requirements within the same 90-day period. They said from the time of adoption through publication, it would be wise for all carriers to review their practices, but they felt like you should have already been in compliance with many of these to start with. But even so, they provided an additional 90 days for the rules to, you know, come into effect before enforcement. So no small carrier exemption for the data security rules. The 90 days is the same for everybody. However, there is a small carrier exemption for the notice and choice consent provisions. Small providers do get an additional 12 months to come into compliance with the requirements that we're going to talk about next week related to updating privacy policies, getting consents to use information, including sensitive information, to the extent that you don't already have that consent. And just as a reminder, small providers are defined in the order as providers with 100,000 or fewer broadband connections, and small voice providers with 100,000 or fewer subscriber lines, as reported on the most recent Form 477. And that's aggregated over all of the providers' affiliates as well. So, sorry, Alex.
Great. No, not at all. So thank you, Kristen and Adam. So at this point in the presentation, we're going to start talking about breach notification. And as a reminder to the earlier part of our presentation, breach notification is following or is pegged to the OMB timeline for implementation of these rules, not strictly the data security element of the rules, which come into effect 90 days after publication in the Federal Register. But often, and in DWT's internal materials as well, we think of breach notification as part of the information security program, and for a good reason, which I'll talk about in a little bit, which is that you really need to know where your CPI is and who has access to it. So we'll talk about, you know, what is a breach, what is the harm trigger that the FCC has adopted, and some of the mechanical elements like thresholds for notification and consumer notifications and what those are supposed to look like. So it's important to note that the definition of the breach, which we have in red on the slide here, is that it's any instance in which a person without authorization or exceeding authorization gains access to CPI. And what this means, as Adam mentioned earlier, is that you can have a situation where you have an employee who accidentally accesses information without authorization. They get a login, they're given the wrong permission by IT, something like that. And strictly speaking, that is a breach under the FCC's rules. Now, what are the additional elements of the rules that mitigate those situations, right? Well, the main one is the harm trigger, and we're going to spend a couple slides talking about this because it's got some interesting elements to it. The basic rule is that a carrier, and I want to emphasize that it's the carrier's responsibility to make this determination. The carrier, upon reasonable determination of a breach, has to send notice to customers, its customers, the FCC, and law enforcement, again, depending on the threshold number of customers affected, unless the carrier can reasonably determine that no harm is likely to result from that breach. And so we want to spend some time talking about what harm is and how a carrier can make that determination. One note before I move to the next slide is that the FCC intends to create a central reporting system for reporting these breaches. That will be done by a public notice that will come out at some point in the future. Unfortunately, the FCC's order is pretty light on the details for what that might entail, whether it is just a checkbox about did this breach affect more than a certain number of customers, or whether it's a more fulsome reporting system where you can submit copies of customer notifications or things like that, but we'll have to wait and see. So turning back to this question, determining likelihood of harm, according to the FCC, harm includes several different things, and the first few that are listed here are fairly straightforward. You know, financial and economic harm, clearly, if a credit card number is disclosed, then there's a risk of identity theft. The FCC lists identity theft itself as a potential avenue of harm. Physical harm is pretty clear cut. But these last few, emotional harm, reputational damage, personal embarrassment, loss of control over the exposure of intimate personal details, all reside in kind of a gray area and really do have a subjective element to them. Now, the FCC has said and kind of created a bright line presumption that sensitive information, which we talked about earlier, things like precise geolocation and other elements that the FCC has listed in the order, are presumed to be harmful. So if when the carrier is making a determination about whether there's a likelihood of harm and sensitive information is involved, the onus is on the carrier to rebut this presumption, right? And that can provide some guidance, but we do note that it will probably take some time and potentially some explanation in enforcement actions to really understand what the FCC considers to be reputational damage. So a few other elements of harm. There are no safe harbors, again, as was mentioned earlier, at all. If you all are familiar with state data breach law, you'll note that in many cases, encryption can be a safe harbor. So in other words, if you have encrypted a data set, presumably when it is accessed, no one can read the information, so it's not a breach. But here, the FCC considers encryption to be only one of the multitude of factors that a carrier needs to take into account when it's trying to determine whether a breach has occurred. So things like how strong the encryption is, whether the keys were stolen along with the encrypted information, and potentially even the sophistication of the party who is suspected to have received the information and their capabilities to defeat the encryption, all are these are fair game in this analysis. And again, the intent of the party responsible for the breach is irrelevant. So accidents, the fact that an employee accessed it versus and some other third party are all not relevant to the rule. Basically, what all this means is that the burden is on the carrier to make the determination whether there's been a reportable breach. As part of that determination, the carrier needs to understand or determine whether there has been harm, and all of these elements go into that analysis. So now we get into the much easier mechanical element of the data breach. Once you've gone through that whole analysis, determined that, yes, in fact, there is a reportable data breach, then you have to consider the thresholds for notification. And those thresholds revolve around this 5,000 customers affected number. So if you've got 5,000 or more customers affected, then there has to be notification to those customers, to the FCC, and to the FBI and Secret Service within the time frames that we list there. And I won't read those off. You all can read those for yourselves. But it's a fairly short time frame of within seven business days of the reasonable determination that a breach has occurred. Customer notification is always 30 calendar days. So if there are fewer than 5,000 people, then it's notification to the customers and to the FCC. There's no need to also notify the FBI and Secret Service. So what has to go into the customer breach notification? Well, there are two elements to this, the content itself and then the method by which you can notify a customer of a breach. The content is fairly straightforward. It's these five elements, the date or estimated date range, description, contact information for both the carrier and the FCC and any relevant state agencies. And if there's some risk of financial harm, then information about national credit reporting agencies and some additional information about how to protect identity. And then the method is of delivering the customer breach notification is fairly permissive compared to state law. Notification can be written or emailed, or the carrier has the option to provide an alternative method like text messaging, assuming that the carrier has obtained the consent of the customer to get that alternative method of notification. The tricky part with customer breach notification is the interaction with state law, because all customers are going to be residents of a state. The carrier, when it makes this determination that a breach has occurred, has to look to state law as well. And those are going to have a multitude of factors. There may be a situation in which there's a reportable breach for FCC purposes, but not a reportable breach for state purposes, because the threshold isn't met, for example. But many states also dictate the content of the customer breach notification. So Massachusetts, for example, does not allow you to tell a customer what happened in the course of the breach. California provides safe harbor guidance for what should be in the notification. And all these things have to be taken into account when a carrier is trying to figure out who to notify and when it has to notify them. And that doesn't, and I also didn't mention that the timelines will differ. If a breach occurs, you may need to notify the FCC with one notification, but then notify a state attorney general at a different time. You may need to update the FCC, because in the privacy order, the FCC does state that it expects updates if new information about the breach is discovered. This is all to say that harmonizing the content of FCC and state consumer notification is going to be pretty critical in order to save time in these relatively short time frames. Finally, a few recommendations based on the discussion we've had so far. Clearly, you need to know what CPI you have and where it resides in your systems and potentially even your vendor systems, because that's going to help you comply with the 7-day time frame. There is a little bit of flexibility in the time frame, given that the carrier has the duty to make a determination about when a breach has occurred. So an employee may discover a breach on Monday, but it may be finally confirmed on Friday. Friday would be the day that the clock starts running on those 7 days that you have to notify the FCC and the 30 days to notify the customer. And then, of course, have a response plan. And if you have been following Adam's helpful recommendations earlier in the presentation, you'll already have an answer to these and more questions that will help you figure that out. So with that, I'm going to turn it back over to Kristen for some final thoughts and any remaining questions.
Great. Thank you, Alex. Thank you, everybody. There is one question that we can address before we move on to the road ahead. Question, are there any documentation requirements with respect to the determination of whether harm is likely? In other words, do carriers have to document their investigative process for determining whether notifications must be done? I think that is a tricky question. The rules themselves do not require that. The rules themselves only require that you have to keep that a carrier or an ISP, which is also a carrier now, it's just hard for me to say, that you have to keep records of the breaches that rise to the level of notification, and that those records only have to be maintained for a period of 2 years. That said, you will go through investigations. There will be close calls, especially when you're trying to decide, if these rules actually go into effect and if you are going to have to make a decision, could somebody's access of this information cause reputational harm? Maybe it's video data. that was streamed over the you know, your broadband service, and that has leaked out somewhere. Do you need to provide those notifications? That's going to be considered sensitive data, and there's going to be a presumption that it would cause the harm that the FCC is saying triggers notice. And if that, you know, if there is a consumer complaint, the consumer has come to you before, you're definitely going to need to have something to be able to rebut that presumption against you and why you made the choice you made. So I guess the answer is no, there's no requirement by the rules, but as you're going through the investigative process to, you know, if you're making close calls and you decide not to notify, you may, for your own defensive purposes, want to keep those records.
There's another question for us. I'll read it for you. Can you clarify, once these rules go into effect, will the breach notification requirements apply to both telephone CPNI and broadband CPNI?
Yes. Yes, they'll apply to both.
There we go.
So in the last few minutes that we have, you know, I think the only thing new on this slide, you know, that we should maybe spend a minute on is the FTC enforcement. So again, given the uncertainty of what happens in 90 days, in 6 months, when the breach notification, you know, or so, when the breach notification rules may go into effect or may not, you know, what happens here? If these rules don't go into effect, will the FTC enforce these rules, you know, enforce privacy and data security against ISPs? The answer to that specifically is no. Until there is some sort of removal of broadband internet access service from under Title II, ISPs will be considered common carriers, and the FTC will not be able to enforce, because currently they bring all of their enforcement actions under Section 5 of the FTC Act regarding unfair and deceptive acts and practices, and common carriers are specifically exempted from that or excluded from their jurisdiction. The Ninth Circuit reference on this page is an AT&T case where the court has said if an entity is a common carrier for one service, then it's a common carrier for all services, and therefore the FTC cannot enforce any aspect of that common carrier's business or related services. That is currently being challenged, and the FCC has actually weighed in on that and stated why that's wrong. So right now that's only in the Ninth Circuit. There have been other cases where the FTC has brought enforcement actions against telecom carriers for, you know, not CPNI violations, of course, but for other consumer protection issues. This is something that we're just going to have to monitor and see how it plays out in the courts and in practice. But if it stands and the FTC truly cannot enforce privacy protections against, you know, either ISPs or you know, or any other portion of the business, I would, you know, again, going down to this privacy as a bipartisan issue, the FCC is not going to stand by and let consumers be harmed. They will find a way to enforce, even under a Republican regime. Again, going back to the 2007 authentication rules, that was a Republican-led FCC that led that rulemaking and put those rules into place. You know, and on the state data breach laws, and I think we should talk a little bit about preemption here, which we haven't really discussed. Alex was talking about the various requirements from the state data breach laws. There really isn't anything that contradicts those laws to date in the FCC's rules. You can accommodate the FCC requirements currently under every state data breach law. So that, again, will be something that we just need to monitor. And the preemption itself works in a kind of strange way. They don't actually preempt it, but preempt any state laws, but if there is a conflict, you can bring it before the FCC and ask the FCC to decide how it should be addressed. Not the most efficient. We'll see what happens there. Is there anything else on state data breach laws that you guys wanted to emphasize?
No.
I think that actually, unless we have any other...
There's one more question here. I'll read it off. Has DWT prepared a template or outline of a written data security program or other materials that may be necessary to comply with these new rules?
We do have, we have various templates, and maybe what we can do after this is, not necessarily share a template, but we could do a checklist.
Right.
So everybody on the call, you get notice that, we'll put a checklist out either as a client advisory or on our blog so that you can go and at least reference that. But if you do have any other questions, any of the presenters on the phone, and certainly we have many other attorneys here with expertise that some of you may have worked with, feel free to reach out directly.
Thank you. A link to an online evaluation is now displayed on your screen. Please take a few minutes to complete it. We do appreciate your feedback. This concludes today's webinar. Thank you for attending.